You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Icelanders go to the polls tomorrow to elect a president. In a country which frequently sees the incumbent returned unopposed, a large field is taking on long-serving Ólafur Ragnar Grímsson. We'll ask why. The euro spikes slightly against the dollar. Is this the beginning of the end of the interminable euro crisis, or merely another case of confusing the light at the end of the tunnel with an oncoming locomotive?
There are big problems that need to be resolved in this. It's a long, slow process. We're talking about recovering confidence in the markets as a sort of 3, 5, even 10-year process. It's a very long process.
We'll be joined in the studio by Orlando Figes, author of an extraordinary new book about life in the Soviet gulags. And we'll employ expert help to settle an office debate. Which nation speaks the loudest?
My name is Jack and I'm from Essex in the UK. And the reason we are the loudest is because people need to know that we have apples and pears to sell. Brandy bananas, get your bowl of bananas, pat about.
He's been saving that one up for some time. All of that, plus robot waiters, no really, plus some music as well, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. An action-packed 60 minutes ahead, but first, the latest headlines with Roger Crisp.
The UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon says he hopes that Saturday's special meeting in Geneva will prove to be a turning point leading to the implementation of Kofi Annan's peace plan for Syria. The UN Action Group's meeting will be attended by 9 countries, although Russia said today that it regretted that Iran, Saudi Arabia, Jordan and Lebanon had not been invited to the crisis talks. Meanwhile, 28,000 Syrians are finding refuge in Lebanon, where they are preparing themselves for a long stay as the conflict in their home country drags on. Under pressure to prevent a catastrophic breakup of their single currency, Eurozone leaders agreed today to let their rescue fund inject aid directly into stricken banks from next year and intervene on bond markets to support troubled member states. European Council President Herman Van Rompuy said the aim was to create, by the end of this year, a supervisory mechanism involving the European Central Bank, thus breaking the vicious circle between banks and sovereign governments.
The building block of banking integration is the most important one in the sense that we can achieve results in a short time frame and in the banking framework, the surveillance, the European organized surveillance. And we are delivering already a few hours after we presented our report.
On news of the agreements, the euro jumped nearly 2% in value and European shares reached a 7-week high. Bank of England Governor Mervyn King launched an angry attack on British banking culture today, saying something had gone very wrong with an industry that had resorted to deceitful methods to make money. King, the UK's most powerful monetary official, said a fundamental overhaul was needed after a string of financial scandals.
We don't need an inquiry to know what we should be doing. What I hope is that everyone now understands that something went very wrong with the UK banking industry and we need to put it right. We can see that we need a real change in the culture of the industry. And that will require two things. One is leadership of an unusually high order and changes to the structure of the industry.
In California, proposals to add to the energy supply by using hydraulic fracturing, referred to simply as fracking, have brought together environmentalists and farmers. All are concerned about the impact of fracking on the water supply in a state where shortages are often a problem. Fracking is the pumping of chemical-laced water and sand into a well to open cracks that release oil and gas and has generated a fierce US-wide debate, leading to bans in one state and also in several municipalities. In Africa's Ivory Coast, an investigation by a US workers' rights group has found that child labour is still widespread on cocoa farms supplying Nestlé. In response, the world's biggest food group has pledged a redoubling of efforts to stamp out the practice. The Fair Labour Association said that this was the first time a multinational chocolate producer had allowed its procurement system to be completely traced and assessed. And that's the news here at Monocle 24.
Thanks, Roger. It's 5 minutes past 1800 hours here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
Monocle 24 is your episode.
This is Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper jalapet. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24, and this is Midori House, live from Studio One in London. Icelandic presidential elections are not always riveting contests. On no less than 9 occasions since Iceland became independent in 1944, the incumbent has retained the job without having to go to the polls at all, as nobody has bothered to run against them. Tomorrow's presidential election is different, though long-serving president Olafur Ragnar Grimsson has won 2 of the 4 terms he has already served unopposed. A considerable field is hoping to prevent him securing a 5th. No fewer than 7 alternative candidates have thrown their fur hats into the ring. And joining us now to consider their chances is Stefania Oskarsdottir, a lecturer in political science. Political silence? Chance would be a fine thing. Political science at the University of Iceland. Good evening, Stefania.
Hello to you.
First of all, I was hoping you could tell us a bit about the Icelandic presidency as an office. What kind of role does the Icelandic head of state usually play?
In many ways, it's very similar to the one that the Queen of England has. We are a parliamentary democracy, and traditionally, the head of state is just a figurehead. But different from the Queen of England, the President of Iceland needs to sign laws. I mean, I guess the Queen does that too. But in the event that the President refuses to sign laws into so that they take effect, there is to be held a referendum. And this has happened twice in the past 2 years on the Icesave deals that were quite controversial here in Iceland. And this also made the President somewhat... it made him popular with a majority of the Icelanders, but fairly unpopular with the political class, especially the leaders of the government, because they felt that his decisions had derailed the economic recovery program and the agreements that they had reached with Britain and Holland and the IMF.
So has President Grimsson been an unusually interventionist or activist president?
No, I mean, these are the only 2 instances, really. Well, there was this other incident back in 2004 when he refused to sign controversial laws on regulating the media. But these laws were retrieved by Parliament, by the government, and annulled. So in most ways, he's been, a very traditional president. Although, I mean, when he was elected, he had a past as the chairman of the leftist People's Alliance. And so he was a political figure. He had been a minister of finance, and before that he had been a professor of political science. So, and by now he has almost 50 years of experience, on the political scene.
And he was, of course, president throughout the great Icelandic boom and then the bust and then, I guess, the sort of budding recovery of recent years. Is he perceived to have handled this whole period well?
Well, no, there are critics who claim that he went overboard in his enthusiasm for Icelandic entrepreneurs, And we have been dealing with the aftermath of the banking collapse here for almost 4 years, and we're still, talking about this and who's to blame and who's responsible and so on and so forth. And by many, the president is believed to have some, that he was very very much a promoter of this idea that Iceland had something unique to sell. And many people here in Iceland don't forgive him for that. But he redeemed himself in the eyes of you could say the common man on the street when he decided to refuse to sign these two legislations on ISAFE.
So why does he find himself running against such a large field this time?
There are several reasons, but the main outstanding reason is the fact that now the whole constitution of Iceland is under revision, and nobody knows what kind of a constitution we'll have. 25 people were elected to a special constitutional assembly. These people did not have much of a political experience, nor were they experts on constitutional matters or political science, and they were given 3 months to write up a new constitution. And this draft is now scheduled for a referendum. And after this referendum, Parliament is to take the draft and do whatever it wants with it. Nobody knows what the eventual outcome will be. And in this draft, there are some substantial proposals that would change the constitution. One is that it might perhaps, expand presidential powers. Another one is that it will change the electoral system and make political parties less, less relevant, really. And so in this, given this uncertainty about the role of the presidency in the future, there were many who believed that the president would be the best sort of interim candidate, to see the changes through. So that, because it was argued that it was unfair to voters and even possible candidates to run for office or vote for candidates into a role or office that nobody knew what would look like in let's say, 2 years' time.
Well, according to polling so far, the most plausible candidate running against the president is Thora Arnorsdottir, who's a television journalist. What are the particular points of difference between her and the president?
In the beginning, she ran on the platform that it was time for change. That, he had been president for 16 years and somewhat implied was his criticism that he had done wrong by refusing to sign the legislation on ISAFE. But that was not a very not a very sellable point, because most Icelanders believe that it was a good turn of events. And the president has been expanding this theory about the power of the people and how direct democracy can become a counterweight to a parliament that is unpopular and so on and so forth. Because the president had come out very strongly when he began his campaign opponent of Iceland joining the European Union. And polls here in Iceland show that most Icelanders don't favor joining the European Union, whereas Thora was silent on this issue, and her opponents could use it against her, sort of implying that she actually favored EU membership, that she would actually have signed the ISAFE legislation, and that she was a candidate of the government. And the government at the moment is quite unpopular. There's been polling consistently with less than 30% support. And there's also quite low support for parliament as an institution. It's down to 10%. And in this climate of, distress towards government and feelings of that nature, you could say rhetoric or theory or whatever, of the president, where he's sort of promoting more people power, more direct democracy, and so on and so forth. It's fairly attractive to many people. And also in this sort of, they think they know him. He's been a president for 16 years. Thora is unknown as a political figure or public figure, although she is very well liked 37-year-old TV broadcaster. As we know, it's always very hard for challengers to challenge incumbents. And it's been an uphill battle. It looked quite good in the beginning when she had the lead. She was actually a front runner in the beginning. But for the last, let's say, 5-6 weeks, she has been behind. And the latest polls show that the president would probably win with a almost a 20% margin. He's, you know, polls yesterday showed him to have 50 to 57%, you know, ratings.
Stefania Óskarsdóttir, lecturer in political science at the University of Iceland, thank you very much for joining me this evening. You're listening to Midori House.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth-largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit, too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
You're listening to Midori House. And now the Euro crisis, part umpty dozen in an apparently unending series. For today, at least, a whiff of optimism is born on the summer breeze. After 13 hours of talks in Brussels yesterday, the continent's leaders seem to have reached agreement on measures to shore up the increasingly rickety Eurozone. It has been decided that Europe's planned bailout fund will be deployed to directly support struggling banks without adding to government debt. Earlier today, Quentin Peel, Berlin bureau chief for the Financial Times, who is in Brussels following the story, explained it all to Matt Barbett.
You're in Brussels, so you're right at the heart of it then. So spell out what emerged from there.
It certainly looks as if Angela Merkel has given a bit of ground, although the more you look at it, the more there are an awful lot of detail that's got to be filled in between the cracks. I'm not at all sure that Mario Monti has got an enormous amount for Italy. It says they'll use funds more flexibly to intervene in the market and so on. I think the victors here have been Spain. Mariano Rajoy has got a deal where he'll get money direct from the rescue funds without it having to go on the government books for debt. And the Irish have been promised that they'll get any deal that will be made up to them as good as the Spanish get. So they're the bigger winners, I think. And Frau Merkel is going to have to go home to Germany and actually have a difficult job selling it to her own backbenches that she's given ground she'd sort of promised not to.
There is this 10-year plan that's been talked about, designed to strengthen the Eurozone and prevent future crises like the one we're going through at the moment. But critics say that will not adequately address the current debt problems.
Well, that's the balance, really. There is obviously a panic in the markets, or, you know, a degree of massive insecurity in the markets over the Eurozone. They're looking for short-term reassurance. Merkel has been adamant that that actually is just sticking plaster, and that what's needed is to, if you like, repair the hole in the heart of European monetary union, which is that it's monetary union, but not an economic union or indeed a political union. That's what she's really trying to persuade them to move on. We're only going to get words today. We're not going to get final decisions on that. But if they clearly set a direction and give themselves a deadline, then maybe that actually is more reassuring to the markets in the long term than sticking plaster and throwing money at things in the short term.
I mean, in the short term, the markets seem, you know, moderately reassured by this. You touched on Eurobonds there, Quentin. Let's talk about them. There is going to be a pilot launch of the Eurobonds, something, as you said, that Germany had been largely against till now, or at least in public. Do you think that could be a success, that Eurobond pilot?
Well, no, I think we've got to be quite careful now. It isn't a Eurobond pilot. It's a much, much more restricted thing. These are the project bonds, I think, that they're talking about.
Right.
Very time-restricted and going through the books of the European Commission or with European Commission guarantees. It's not really borrowing with a German guarantee. That's what the Germans are really worried about. But each time that something like this is done, I suppose it is another small step towards the eventual target. I think we're talking a 10-year game plan here. I don't think we're likely to see Eurobonds introduced much sooner than 10 years, because the Germans are going to have a major constitutional change themselves, as well as treaty changes in Europe, to allow it. And now we're hearing the Germans talking very seriously about a referendum in Germany. Now, that is an enormous gamble and one that no government in Germany will undertake lightly. They haven't had a referendum in Germany nationally since 1933.
And let's talk about their French neighbours. And it strikes me that François Hollande, the relatively new French president, has come out of this looking fairly statesmanlike.
Yes, he's presented himself pretty well. He was talking in the middle of the night about how he understood entirely where Mario Monti and Mariano Rajoy were coming from, and that basically he supported them. He said, we've got to do something for them on short-term interest rates. So he comes out, if you like, quite cleverly having positioned himself on the side of everything that they've agreed on. Whereas Angela Merkel, for once, the woman who's, after all, dictated all European policy now throughout the crisis, she comes out looking as if she's had to give way. It may be somewhat a matter of presentation, but German communication strategy on this has been pretty dreadful.
Quentin, just to finish off, I mean, this was the umpteenth summit, in as many months, pretty much. And they haven't come out with a cast iron guarantee to sort the crisis out once and for all. So what do you think is going to happen next?
We'll have another. I was talking to Herman Van Rompuy a couple of weeks ago. He said he'd already had 15 summits.
Yes.
So presumably this is his 16th. I fear that solutions for the Eurozone are never going to be one-off, big bazooka, whatever you like to call it. There are big problems that need to be resolved in this. It's a long, slow process. We're talking about recovering confidence in the markets as a sort of 3, 5, even 10-year process. It's a very long process, and I think it's going to be messy, it's going to be muddly, and we're going to have to sticking plaster solutions all the time.
That was Quentin Peel, the Financial Times Berlin bureau chief, speaking to Matt Barbett earlier. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And we'll be talking typography next. But first, this is a track from a Midori House session, which we recorded here in the studio last month. It's Todd Snyder, and this is Looking for a Job.
You can't talk to me like that, boy. I don't care who you are. If you don't want to have to hang your own drywall, don't push me too far. Boomtown work ain't that hard to come by. Boomtown workers are. You might be the one running the show, but that doesn't mean you're in charge. I was looking for a job when I found this one. Don't need this work like you need the work done. You look like you're under pressure. I was looking for a job when I met you. I'm sharing a room with two guys over at the Motel 6 bar. Send every dime I make here home to my ex-wife. Just did 2 years and 28 days. With a little better aim, I'd been in there for my life. So you see, broke won't take much getting used to. Neither will a barbed wire jailhouse wall. Watch what you say to someone with nothing. It's almost like having it all. I was looking for a job when I found this one. Don't need this work like you need this work done. You look like you're under pressure. I was looking for a job when I met you.
That was the very great Todd Snyder live here at Midori House with Looking for a Job. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, this year's Typography Congress in Valencia will be focusing on how technological advances have been changing both typefaces and the work of the people who design them. The emergence of a new field of design, web design, in which typography is still in its relative infancy, has changed the way professionals approach their craft. Previously unexplored platforms like Kindles, iPads and smartphones are fertile ground for young talents. A little earlier today, Monocle's creative director Richard Spencer Powell and Tom Edwards spoke to Andre Belliou, who's the organiser of this year's event.
Andre, the first thing that I wanted to ask you about the typography conference really was what its main objectives are. What are the kind of things that you're seeking to achieve in Valencia this year?
So we are going to discuss and topics like technology, how technology is influencing the way that we design, and how new media, tablets, cell phones, iPhones, and so on, are affecting the way we read. So more or less, we are trying to discuss all these things, and maybe it's not to, it would be difficult to get to reach a conclusion after all, but we'll try to raise some questions, and we have invited speakers that are experts in different areas.
And just in terms of the city of Valencia, what does the conference mean to the city, and particularly to the Spanish designers? Is this a real boost for the Spanish sort of typography business?
Yeah, sure. Because maybe not exactly for business, because type business in Spain is in a very low level, and mainly now that we are living in a very hard economic recession. But it's important in terms of the profession and in terms of how typography is considered among the professionals. Not only for type designers, because there are not many type designers in Spain, but as how graphic designers can be more aware about the type design and typography and try to improve the level of typography in the professional field.
You mentioned then that there aren't too many typographers in Spain. Who out there do you feel is doing a good job with type design right now? Which countries or which studios or photographers are doing it well?
Okay, from my point of view, I think the most interesting stuff right now is being done in countries like Holland, England, Germany, the States, and at this moment in Latin America, South America, there are countries that are really relevant in young type designers. So we will hear about their work in dressing in the coming years.
And if we just return just to the subject of technology, is it too early in the conference to have a read on whether it's whether everyone feels it's positive? That obviously type is a very old art form. It's a very old craft, and technology, as we know, moves incredibly quickly. Is there enthusiasm for the speed technology moves, or are people longing for a return to letterpress and all the old sort of techniques that lots of people cherish?
Yeah, in fact, we're going to have a round table, so a discussion panel where we are going to discuss about these both worlds, so the analogic world and the technological world, you know, because as long as our society is getting more and more involved in technology, and as far as we have young generations that are living in very surrounded with technology, we have also a kind of attitude that is looking to analogic technology, to letterpress, to metal type in a new way. So we have been living also a kind of phenomena, a kind of trend, nostalgic trend going to letterpress. So we'll be also discussing a little bit about why this is this way.
I was just wondering, typography and font design seem to be having a bit of a surge in popularity of late. I see more and more design studios designing their own fonts, more and more clients wanting a bespoke font. When Apple launched their new iPad and its new screen resolution, they talked, you know, in depth about typography. Is that a trend that you've also spotted, and do you think, you know, why has there been this sort of resurgence in again, what is quite an old form of design?
Typography may be one of the specialties in graphic design that is being, or is having at this moment, a great interest, at least in Spain, because it stands out from what the graphic design itself. You know, you can see a lot of graphic design everywhere, and graphic design is very popular. And typography, some designers look at typography as something a little bit more specific, where you need time, you need kind of expertise and more skills. So it's something that stands out a little bit from the design world. Although typography is part of design, of course, but it's something more specific.
And that was André Balliou, organiser of the Typography Congress in Valencia, talking to Monocle's Richard Spencer-Powell and Tom Edwards. You're listening to Midori House. And in the next half hour of Midori House, we will be asking which nation speaks the loudest with the enthusiastic help of Monocle's staff.
My name is Alexios. I am Greek and we are the loudest nation because we're still in the EU. Just.
We'll be putting that assertion to the test later. But first, here's Roger Crisp with the news headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. The UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon says he hopes that Saturday's special meeting in Geneva will prove to be a turning point, leading to the implementation of Kofi Annan's peace plan for Syria. Meanwhile, 28,000 Syrians are finding refuge in Lebanon, where they are preparing themselves for a long stay as the conflict in their home country drags on. Under pressure to prevent a catastrophic breakup of their single currency, Eurozone leaders agreed today to let their rescue fund inject aid directly into stricken banks from next year and intervene on bond markets to support troubled member states. On news of the agreements, the euro jumped nearly 2% in value and European shares reached a seven-week high. Bank of England Governor Mervyn King launched an angry attack today on British banking culture, saying that something had gone very wrong with an industry that had resorted to deceitful methods to make money. In Africa's Ivory Coast, an investigation by a US workers' rights group has found that child labour is still widespread on cocoa farms supplying Nestlé. In response, the world's biggest food group has pledged a redoubling of efforts to stamp out the practice. And internet users in mainland China have found that Bloomberg's websites have been blocked by local authorities. Bloomberg thinks that the move is in response to an article published about the fortunes of Vice President Xi Jinping's extended family. And those are the headlines here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. Coming up shortly, we'll be talking to historian Orlando Figes about his new book. But before that, this is First Aid Kit with one of our favourite songs of the year. This is Emmylou. That was Emmylou by First Aid Kit. It's 18:35 here in London. You're listening to Midori House. The Soviet gulags are a crime and a tragedy rendered almost incomprehensible by their scale. In the decades that the archipelago of labour camps functioned, from the late 1920s to the mid-1950s, somewhere between 18 and 20 million people served time in them and more than a million of them died. Well, sometimes the best way to tell such a big story is to tell a small story. The historian Orlando Figes, previously the author of the monumental survey of the Russian Revolution, A People's Tragedy, among other works, has taken a more intimate approach to his study of the gulags. Just Send Me Word is founded on a correspondence of hundreds of illicit letters smuggled between two inmates of the gulags, young Muscovite lovers Lev and Sveta. Orlando Figes joins me in the studio now. Welcome to Midori House, Orlando. First of all, how did you find these two characters?
Well, it was an incredibly lucky find. I was at the Human Rights Organization Memorial in Moscow in 2007, and three large trunks, I virtually tripped over them, had just come in. The smallest of them containing, as you say, actually about 1,500 letters smuggled in and out of a labour camp in the far north of Russia. The prisoner was a guy called Lev Mishenko, and his girlfriend was in Moscow at the time, Svetlana. And it was an incredibly lucky find in the sense that this was not just the most, not just the largest archive ever to come out of the Gulag, but really important because we had both sides of the correspondence. Obviously, prisoners would keep letters because they treasured them. But for someone like Svetlana, who, you know, is, for her, it was dangerous because she was working in an area of military industrial research. For someone like in that position to keep letters from a prisoner was highly dangerous. So they have both sides of the correspondence. It's incredibly revealing because, as you say, it's smuggled, so it's not really passing through censors' hands. But what really drew me to them was that the letters are just very beautifully written because they're written by two exceptional people.
I mean, it's an astounding historical find. And how did I mean, as you say, the unusual part of it is that you have a back and forth. You have
complete
a conversation.
Correspondence, all of them carefully numbered.
So how did it come to be all gathered in this trunk? How did the letters get there?
Well, the letters were smuggled in and out. Then Lev would keep the letters coming in to him and hide them under a plank in his barracks. And then because he had a friend who was a prisoner but in charge of a laboratory where he could hide his letters, he took them there. And then when one of the free workers inside the zone, I mean, this is one of the paradoxes of the gulag, it had a barbed wire zone, but within it were free workers living there who could come and go. And they would occasionally take a batch of letters out and take them back to Moscow or send them back to Moscow, and Svetlana would store them there. But they never saw the historical significance of the letters, I think, until about the 2000s, when Lev began to write his memoirs about the war years, because in the Second World War, before his incarceration in the Gulag from 1946, in the war years he was a prisoner in Germany, and he wrote his memoirs about that period. And he began to see that they had historical significance. He'd just seen them as these treasured letters until that point. So they gave them to Memorial in 2007.
But you, up until this point, must have read everything that there was to be read about the Gulag. So from these first-person reports, did you learn anything that surprised you?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. They're tremendously revealing, particularly Lev's letters coming out, revealing of the psychology of a prisoner living through the labour camp. I mean, if you think about it, we believe that his letters are the only major real-time record of daily life in the camp. I mean, we have, in a labour camp, we have lots of memoirs written with the benefit of hindsight. But he can really talk in a very articulate way about what he's going through. And I think we learn how it's not so much the physical hardships. I mean, they were bad enough that wear a prisoner down. It's you know, the sense of isolation, the sense of mistrust that people wouldn't believe him anymore, that he would lose everybody he cared for outside the camp. It's the fear of a convoy, of being sent to a more remote Arctic colony where he would lose all contact with Svetlana and anybody else he cared about. It's the fear of falling ill because of the poor medical treatment for prisoners inside the barbed wire zone. All of these things, which you're sort of vaguely aware of before, really come out in the correspondence. And then the other thing I think that comes out is just how chaotic it all was. It wasn't just the letters that were smuggled in and out. Incredibly, Svetlana smuggles herself into the labour camp on no less than 5 occasions to see him. And I just couldn't believe. I mean, this is completely unprecedented.
Well, you tend to think of these places more as places that people would break out
yeah,
of.
Yeah, and people were breaking out of them. And they were doing it in the same way, which is by bribing guards, because guards were corrupt. Guards were drinking vodka all the time. So there was a sort of violent chaos about the place, which you could exploit if, like Svetlana, you were incredibly courageous and driven by this absolute desire to see her man, which she does. She does it on 5 occasions. And I couldn't really understand how it was possible for her to do it. Luckily, in addition to the letters, I managed to get hold of what is in effect the KGB archive of the labour camp itself. And that, for a historian, is a tremendous privilege, because then you could then compare what Lev was writing on a daily basis about his experience with what, you know, the administration of the labour camp was observing about prisoners and reporting on conditions.
Now, am I right in thinking you met this couple?
I did.
Shortly before Lev died. How did they feel about their letters being turned into a book and this document of the gulags?
Well, they gave the archive to Memorial. I was chosen as the historian to work with them by Memorial. And, it was a tremendous privilege. I mean, they were in the early 90s at that stage. We didn't have all the letters transcribed. It took 2 years from the first discovery of the letters to get them transcribed. And that obviously I wanted to meet them as early as possible, because although the letters are uncensored, there are many things in them that are sort of slightly disguised. Names are just described with initials. So I needed them to be able to explain them. So I went and did 3 or 4 days of filmed interviews with them. And they were an extraordinary couple. Lev was still very agile, very strong for a small man. Only the strong survived the gulag. And had a photographic memory, which was tremendously useful. Svetlana retained a huge sense of humour about her. I remember at one point we asked her what she thought was Lev's greatest quality, and my fellow interviewer suggested it was his vierness, his believability, the fact that he was a man who was true and could be believed. And Svetlana says, yes, I just can't work out why I believed him in the first place.
I mean, this is almost that rarest of things, isn't it? This is a Russian history book with a happy ending.
Absolutely,
Maybe the first of its kind. Now, you've written, obviously, many other books about Russian history, which, given that they're about Russian history, tend to be slightly hard and indeed soul-destroying work. But does Russian history still captivate you as much as it always did? Or do you get a point dealing with this chronicle of just misery and poverty and just extraordinary ideological stupidity of just thinking, that's enough, I can't take any more of this?
Yeah, you do get a lot of that. I think after the book I'd written called The Whisperers, which was a chronicle of private life done through interviews under the Stalin period, I felt very, very down about the whole thing. But as you say, this story is a huge uplift and has a happy ending, and it tells us a lot about love, really. It really is a book about love. It's a love story, but it's about this extraordinary devotion of Svetlana to Lev to keep him going, to keep his optimism, his spirits going during his 14 years of incarceration. And she helps not only him, but other prisoners. So it's love in the broader sense, that she's not just waiting for him without any expectation he will ever return. And the one thing she wants is a family. She has no children. She has no expectation he'll come back. So she waits for him from the age of 23 to the age of 39. And they do eventually have children. She has her first at the age of 39. I mean, for anybody to do that is an extraordinary sacrifice, an extraordinary element of devotion. But she's helping others through these letters. They're sending diagnoses of prisoners' illnesses. She's sending medicines and vitamins for prisoners who are friends of Lev. And so that's a tremendously uplifting story and teaches us as much about love and the human spirit of endurance as it does about the Gulag itself, I think.
And just finally, to sort of talk about your personal relationship to your own work, have the kind of controversies you've endured personally in the last couple of years, have they altered the way you go about it? Have they made you sort of, I guess, more rigorous in defending your sources, or do you sort of reject the criticisms to start with?
I reject the criticisms to start with. I mean, I think my footnotes and my sources have been available for scrutiny on my website for the last 5 years. My critics have come up with three errors, and I dispute one of them. So I think if you looked at any historian's works, that wouldn't be a bad record to stand by.
Orlando Figes, author of Just Send Me Word, A True Story of Love and Survival in the Gulag. Thank you very much for joining me. You're listening to Midori House. We will be back right after this.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Now, every day on Midori House, we summon one of Monocle's editors from the editorial floor upstairs to talk us through what's in their section of the current issue and what they have coming up. And today it's the turn of our edits editor, Santiago Tarditi. Santiago, welcome to Midori House.
Thank you.
Santiago, I have nothing else to say at this point other than robot waiters. This is a thing. It happens. It exists.
Sounds horrible, huh?
Either that or fantastic. I can't decide which.
But no, I think it's a disgrace to the restaurant scene.
Really? Well, tell us a bit about it. Where is this happening?
Well, this is happening in China. It's the country's fourth robot restaurant. And this one is called the Haohai Robot Restaurant in Harbin.
Okay.
It's staffed by robots, 18 in total, and these robots are doing everything from cooking to serving, and there's even a robot that sings.
Okay, a singing robot. I'm starting to lose interest in this concept right there. But how does this work? Presumably there's human beings in charge, or is this or are we now in the stage where the first artificial intelligence has decided to open a restaurant?
Well, this is a project that is led by an engineer called Liu Hasheng. He invested 5 million yuan, that's around 500,000 pounds, in building this restaurant and the robots. And these robots operate for around 5 hours, and then they take a break, so to say, which is just to recharge the battery that is done in 2 hours of charging directly from a power source. But what I think is really sad is the fact that right now the whole culinary scene is trying to go back to its roots to create a relationship between the producer or the restaurateur or the server and the client, the diner. And this is just distancing the final consumer to the people that are actually interacting with food and so on.
It does sound like a situation in which the food all of a sudden becomes less important than the means by which it's served.
Exactly. Well, we have to consider that in this case, it's just dumplings and noodles. So it's nothing too elaborate. But still, it's always nice, or most of the times it's nice, to interact with the waiter. If you get a nice waiter, it will be an experience you will remember for a long time. Then again, if you have a bad waiter, well, you probably won't want to go back to that restaurant. But here, there's no interaction whatsoever.
And you don't have to tip a robot, of course, so there is that advantage. But how does this actually work? Do the robots come and take your orders?
So you go and order. There's a robot cooking everything in the kitchen. They have some people controlling the whole operation.
I would hope so, or this is a bigger story than it looks.
But, I mean, who are you going to complain to if you find, like, a nut or a bolt in your noodle dish? Can you imagine that?
Yeah, waiter, there's a nut in my soup. Now, the jokes do start to write themselves at that point. There's a chain of these now, though, aren't there? So they're presumably being reasonably successful and popular with Chinese diners.
I looked at some pictures, and it's become quite an entertaining spot to go and to take the families, and a lot of the kids are obviously very, very amused with the whole process and the whole restaurant scene there. But who knows? Who knows? I guess we need to experience it firsthand to actually see how interesting it is and how good the food tastes.
Because this is one of those things that it probably, like a lot of, I guess, automation things, probably seemed relatively laughable or like novelty items when they first happened. And now we just take it, you know, for granted that robots build things and aeroplanes fly themselves and that kind of thing. Maybe we're not that far away from a robot with a Michelin star.
We're close to Star Wars.
Or indeed Star Wars. Would you eat in one of these restaurants, do you think?
I would out of curiosity, and then, who knows, maybe I'll go back.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd go all the way to China, but how far away can the first one in London be? Santiago Tarditi, edits editor for Monocle, thank you very much for joining us. This is Midori House. This is Midori House. I'm Andrew Muller, and I've been looking forward to this item for 50 minutes now. As anyone who has heard Monocle 24's station idents will be aware, this station broadcasts from an office boasting a veritable orchestra of accents, which, given the amount going on in the building at any one time, can sometimes struggle to make themselves heard. And this prompted us to wonder whether some or other nations might have a natural advantage in this respect, or, to put it more crudely, whether some people are just plain louder than others. And here to establish some benchmarks, a Monocle staff in full and diverse cry.
My name's Adrian and I'm from Australia, and we're the loudest people in the world because we're the most uninhibited. We don't care what other people think, we're free.
I'm Santiago, I'm from Colombia. We're the loudest nation because we're very passionate when we speak.
Hi, I'm Nelly, I'm from Bulgaria, and I think we are the loudest nation in the world because we always sound as if we are arguing.
Merhaba, benim adım Alexandra ve dünyadaki en sesli ülke biziz çünkü konuşurken çok heyecanlıyız.
Hi, I'm Luis, I'm from Brazil, and I think we're the loudest nation in the world because we like to emphasize every single word.
My name is Max, I'm from Russia, and we are the loudest nation in the world because we are the biggest.
Hej, jag heter Anton och vi svenskar talar det starkaste för att vi är vikingar.
My name is Danny, I'm from New York, and Americans are the loudest because we have to get our point across.
My name's David, I'm Canadian, and we all speak loud because we can't hear ourselves think over the Americans.
My name is Anna, and I think Portugal is the loudest nation in the world because we have big families and everyone speaks on top of each other.
My name is Alexios, I am Greek, and we are the loudest nation because we're still in the EU. Just.
My name is Jack, and I'm from Essex in the UK, and the reason we are the loudest is because people need to know that we have apples and pears to sell. Brandy bananas, get your bowl of bananas, pat about.
Now, despite Adrian's assertions at the top of that clip, our own Australian kinfolk are, of course, globally renowned for our decorum and are therefore doubtless out of the running. But who really are the world's largest lunged citizens? Well, to help us decide, I'm joined now by Deborah Tannen, Professor of Linguistics at Georgetown University. Good evening, Deborah.
Good evening.
First of all, I have to ask, and nothing personal and so forth, but on the Global Loudness Index, where do you rate Americans?
I think everything is relative. Americans are probably louder than the British, perhaps not quite as loud as Mediterranean, some other cultures. Of course, it's not the language, but the culture that comes across as relatively loud. And of course, when we speak to other people who are relatively loud, we get louder. I loved the comment by the Canadian that they have to speak loudly to be heard over the Americans.
It's all relative, isn't it? the British and the Americans are, I think that's a good place to start, because I, as an outsider to both countries, but I've also spent a long time in both of them, I tend to agree that by and large the Americans are that little bit louder than the British. Why do you think that would be? Where does a kind of national propensity for volume come from?
I think it goes along with a number of other, what I would call, I guess, linguistic features of conversational style. Americans tend to put more emphasis on showing you're enthusiastic, showing you're involved, showing that you are noticing the other person, whereas the British might put relatively more emphasis on showing consideration, that you're not imposing on other people. We both have both these goals all the time, but it's where the relative emphasis is. I have to say, my colleague Peter Treadgill, who is a sociolinguist as I am, and British, some years ago told me that there was a spoof of London transport announcers that was on the web and that was pretty popular, and one of her spoof announcements was, any Americans on the train should be aware that they are almost certainly speaking too loudly. So I think that pretty much shows the impression made.
This is what I was wondering. Is this something you can draw actual hard and fast conclusions about, or is it just something people will tend to have their own personal prejudices about based on their own experiences of certain people?
Yeah, no, I'm sure that it can be measured. In my own research, I actually compared the speaking styles of Americans from the Northeast, the New York City area, compared to those from California and the Midwest. And I did find that the volume tended to be higher. In other words, they spoke more loudly. But they also tended to stand somewhat closer, to speak more quickly, to leave less pause between one turn and the next. I think that's one of the things that makes it relatively difficult for British to get the floor speaking to Americans. It's not just because of the volume, but also because of waiting for a certain space, a certain silence that may not come. Because before it comes, we think you have nothing to say and we're going to fill that uncomfortable silence. I found that as a difference between people from New York City versus the Midwest. But people in California would have the same problem. They'd be interrupting people from New England. And I'm sure you have the same relative differences with different regions of the UK as well.
I mean, is there something to the idea that more, I guess, physically demonstrative cultures, more tactile people tend to be louder in conversation, like, I guess, the Mediterranean and African cultures, or does it just seem, again, does it just seem like that?
No, I think there is a pattern there, yes. So it would be a whole range of features you might call expressive. So you would find more variation in intonation patterns, more waves of up and down, more use of our hands, more broader facial expressions, and again, as I said, other kinesics, that is difference in movement, how closely you stand to the person that you're speaking to. I think of all of it as putting the emphasis on showing your involvement and your engagement. So we heard, for example, somebody say, we're loud because we're passionate. We're loud because we want to get our point across. In a study that I did of workplace communication, there was a British man who spoke very softly. But when he spoke, everybody had to be quiet and listen because he was speaking softly. So he got his point across I think it shows more about the values that we place on expressiveness, that we think speaking more loudly is needed to show that we're passionate.
It is an interestingly counterintuitive idea that sometimes you can attract more attention by making very little noise at all, something I do wish that more people of most nationalities on the London Underground would take heed of. Deborah Tannen, Professor of Linguistics at Georgetown University, thank you very much for joining us. This is Midori House. And that's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. Thank you to our producer Dawn Trump, researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and studio manager Sam Impey. Up next, after the news, it's this week's episode of The Menu with Marcus Hippy, an accent we should have had on earlier. Today we hear from one of Manhattan's original 1920s speakeasies, which has evolved into a modern-day trendy bar.
All of our drinks are served in teacups, and the reason why we do that is, historically speaking, that's how it was during the Prohibition era. All drinks were just a shot and a beer, and in order to fool the public, they would make it look like coffee and tea. That was the advent of the mixed drink.
I've been to that bar, if memory serves, but it was at the end of a very long evening. In 3 hours from now, I'll be back with Emma Nelson for The Daily on Monocle 24. That's at 2200 hours London time. And Midori House will return at the same time on Monday. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend. Goodbye.